You're very welcome to another episode of the Sideshow Garden Podcast. Was it last week or was it the week before? I can't remember. Somebody will correct me on Twitter, at Sideshow on Twitter. Facebook.com, if you're still on that, /The Sideshow. It's on Instagram and all those places. And I'm still with Contrast Cornelius, better known as the apple farmer in Tipperary. And we've moved, and so we're going to change approach on the conversation recorded.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
He's got apples in his hand. And if you remember from the last episode, we were eating plums. And then I ended up with a sort of a in my mouth. I couldn't get it out.
They make the best crunching sound for the radio or for the podcast.
Are you going to do it or will I?
Because you're
going to end up with the twang in your mouth. This is like the advert, isn't it? You know. For that toothpaste.
I'll give it a go as well.
Yours is much better than mine. Now I've got the acid that's hitting the back of my mouth.
Yeah.
I've got to finish it now. You're going to have to, yeah, bear with me. Hold on, put that in my pocket. Domestic. I've got a small back garden, a medium-sized back garden. I say standard back garden is maybe 8 meters by 6 meters. Mm-hmm. I've got a balcony window ledge. I want to grow an apple tree. What do you recommend?
So the first thing to be careful about is getting one on a dwarfing rootstock, because if the apple tree or, you know, plum tree or whatever it is that you get is growing, isn't it growing on a dwarfing rootstock, it will grow too large for your small area. So dwarfing rootstocks in the likes of apples are M27 or M9, and plums are VVA1. So just before you decide what apple to grow, just check that you're going to have a root that will keep the tree small. After that, I always recommend something like Katja or Katie for a one-off tree, because it's self-pollinating. It gives crops most years. Isn't susceptible to powdery mildew or apple scab or canker. So it's a really good, simple apple to grow if you're just going to grow one in the garden.
It's a story that I tell Ella at home. And there's two trees out of back garden. One is Mary and one is John. And John is a pear tree, and he... Bear with me at home, listen to this. One of his branches arched across, and I explained that, and eventually they got to hug each other. And then I planted a new tree, and I told Ella they'd had a baby. Now, that's obviously the joke, but there's method in my madness. It's kind of old Irish fables of don't take all of the wildflowers. They're essentially tales of biodiversity. And if you don't, the little people, the leprechauns, not leprechauns, do you listen in Salt Lake City? The leprechauns will come and they'll play tricks on you.
Yeah, it is really, I suppose... There are very few self-fertile, naturally self-fertile varieties of, you know, of fruits, and that's because, you know, if they do self-pollinate, you know, the likelihood is the genetics of the daughter plant are going to be very similar to genetics of the mother plant, and that's not what nature likes. Nature likes diversity, because the more diversity there is, you know, the more difficult it is for other things to attack the plants and so on. So nature has designed in that it likes to get cross-pollinated. So you need a source of pollen, the father plant, and you need a source of the flower, which is the mother plant. And of course, most of the plants contain both male and female parts, but they don't like to self-pollinate. So they've ways to recognize their own pollen to stop them from self-pollinating. So that's why you need different varieties for self-pollination.
We're getting into monoecious and dioecious. They're big
as
words.
Well. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Never understood those.
Yeah. Well, mono is the easy one if you had a 1980s record player and singular in a nutshell. But dioecious, my apologies, is containing both male and female flowering plants in a nutshell. Bring me back on the rootstock. I was about to say woodstock, but bring me back on the rootstock M9s, etc. And what does that mean to the listener at home who maybe isn't a long-term successful fruit grower as you are?
Yeah, so all trees that you buy, if you go to a garden centre or wherever it is you go to buy a tree, a nursery, all fruit trees will be growing on another root, so they won't be growing on their natural root. If you plant an oak tree or whatever, it'll grow from an acorn, if you like, or you can buy one that's been planted as an acorn and it's on its own root, and it'll grow hopefully to a great old height, and, you know, for a very long time. Fruit trees, I suppose, since Roman times have been grown on not their own root, and that helps people to, you know, to cultivate them in orchards and so on, because if every fruit tree was growing on its own root, you'd have one tall tree, one short tree, they'd all be different. So it's a method of, you know, growing trees that are more like each other. So these rootstocks are used in the same way as roses are grafted or budded onto a root, onto a rose root. It's the same with the apple tree. So a bud is taken from the mother tree and it's grafted onto a rootstock, and that is what produces the tree. But the tree is now, it has two sets of genetics. It has the genetics of the above ground part, which give you the fruit, and has the genetics of the below ground part, which the main, I suppose, characteristic of that is determining how big the tree gets. And they discovered, I suppose, you know, in the 1700s and 1800s, and specifically ones that will keep the tree smaller. And they realized that was easy because people didn't need ladders to climb them and so on to pick them. And those were eventually categorized in the UK in the early 1900s, and they categorized them at random. They assigned them numbers, and then they saw that this one of the smallest ones was M27, another one of the small ones was M9, and that's how those numbers, you know, came into, I suppose, common use or common occurrence.
They're not motorways in a nutshell. No. We're walking to the top. We'd stopped in between, so the main road heading from where I went to college was Kildalton, which is in Piltown, County Kilkenny. And coming up from there, you come into Carrick on Shore, then you come into Clonmel, and then you head up towards Kerr. And I was there recently, as a by the way, at a place called the Swiss Cottage. And you should go, if you are in the region, and check it out. The tour of the house costs about a fiver. I know I'm sidetracking. The grounds of it are absolutely something else. But whilst we're just finding the next spot where we're going to, I'll tell you this story. The house inside was built not as a place of residence, but a place where, at the time, one could go and entertain or show off. And they were explaining to me that about 20 something of the peasants, my apologies, or workers' cottages were flattened at the time to make way for the view going down the Shore River. As a landscape, it makes sense. As the immediate around the house, not so much. Maybe doesn't have very ornate gardens near the house, and I think that's where I'll leave that one for you. But that's called the Swiss Cottage if you're around this neck of the woods. And Con's place obviously does camping, which is where I come, and that's to join the dots between the two of us. And also, we've studied similar subjects in horticulture, and I've got about 30-something fruit trees at home, but his always looked a hell of a lot better than mine. I was about to bring this somewhere, and so I'm going to put this on pause for a sec. So we're standing next to the variety Katie, which was the one that you had just mentioned. And my immediate reaction to you was, that's like something out of Little Red Riding Hood. I'm not far off the mark, and it is that colour.
Yeah, it's a very bright, what is it, scarlet or crimson or something like that. Very pretty red anyway. You could probably paint it onto a Ferrari or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of similar. So it's, from that point of view, it's a nice looking apple as well. It does get a good bit of kind of, you can see some scarring on some of the fruit, all right, but they don't taste any different. They still taste fine. So, you know, I'm always happy to recommend that as a garden apple to people.
And again, whether it's the supermarket buyer walking around or whether it's Peter Donegan, there is a point where you eat with your eyes, maybe the cliche that would work here first. And so if I put down a Granny Smith, for example, that old green 1980s apple, Mam used to buy bags of them for us, long story, one of eight children, etc. And you put down one of these, which would I take? Well, my eyes would always immediately take this one, and then my taste buds would decide whether I like it or not.
That's true. And I suppose the other part of it is things you eat, you know, in your youth build preferences and build memories as well. So I get people who come in here looking for specific apples that, you know, aren't really grown anymore, things like Beauty of Bath and so on, and I don't have them for them either, but they do want to re-experience them because they remember them from their childhood. And sometimes we might have an apple that might be like that or whatever, and you give them those. So it's quite interesting, you know, obviously, you know, the apples that children are being, other foods, but apples too, that children are being given now, I suppose that's going to build up taste memories for them, which will partially, you know, I suppose, dictate what they will like to eat when they're older, I think. I'm delighted when kids come in here and eat some of my Elstars or some of my Katie's or whatever it is, because I'm thinking, well, maybe 20 years down the line they'll still want to experience that particular flavour because they have a certain palate for it because they're eating it when they were younger.
I want to talk to you a little bit, Con, about something that was said to me actually when I was going through college. Might be an easier way to start this, albeit I did my education in the southeast of Ireland, this neck of the woods in a nutshell. Not very many people did fruit as a subject. So I did commercial horticulture, and you did all glasshouse crops, amenity horticulture, or that was landscaping and nursery, etc., the vegetable side of it, and then it was obviously the outdoor fruiting side of it. Or the one point that was made from me by one of the lecturers was, unless you have 100 acres or 20 acres or 50 acres or 1,000 acres, whatever it might be, chances of you becoming a fruit farmer are pretty damn slim. As a Dublin man, Kildare, a Lilywhite, as I was once corrected by my dad, God bless him, but the chances are I was never going to get into it. I would gather, based on that, you're not really going to ever have too many Irish businesses coming into the market, one, to ever compete with you, that is. Two, a comment that was made online, lots of comments are made online, you say, and I appreciate that too, about importing fruit, that we shouldn't, one, need to. Now, when I look at last year, 2018, I think it was, where we had 3 months of snow, we then had 3 months of drought, fruit production or any sort of production was certainly down. When I take 2010-11, the winter of discontent, my apologies as I refer to it, where we had mass floods, and then we had again we had high levels of snow and then went into drought again. You can call it climate change if you want to. We leave that discussion to one side. Historically, over the years, we've ended up in places like that, or weather has had an effect on fruit production, but we also don't produce fruit every single month of the year. I'm getting there, bear with me. And my final point is, if I take potato production as a different example, all of the potatoes that were in store this year, because of the weather that we had last year, were sold on. And so now I know we are importing potatoes because we can't keep up with the demand, one. And two, supermarkets that usually tell you the potato, I think it's written on the back of your packet, might be between 25 or 35 millimetres and 80 millimetres, for example. Then they were all of a sudden taking absolutely anything that was available.
Yeah, no, and I think to go right back to your lecturer and the guy who said, well, you know, if you haven't got a certain amount of acres, you really shouldn't be thinking about fruit. I think that was actually a fair comment in the context of the time. You know, most farms that were growing fruit, especially outdoor fruit like apples, were kind of one-man operations or small family operations. And they would never, you know, probably hire a, you know, a person with a professional horticultural qualification to do something for them, because, you know, probably the kind of starting salary would already be too big to pay. And, you know, I suppose as family enterprises, they would have tended, you know, to be kind of maybe a little bit, I won't say amateurish, but they wouldn't have had a professional attitude like you might see in a large fruit business like Keelings or somebody now, where they hire in all the expertise they need. But things have changed a bit, and especially on as you call it, the Big Island, there's a lot of apples grown now on fairly large scale with a lot of, you know, professional people involved in the production of those. Now, that hasn't happened here in Ireland yet. I know they have small climatic advantages in the UK compared to here, and that's probably part of it, but also our market is very small, so you would probably only need one or two people to put in a large orchard of 300-400 acres, and you would suddenly have, you know, the market of Ireland flooded with Irish apples, which wouldn't be something that I'd be particularly keen on myself, of course, either, unless I was the one flooding the market. I think the person who was giving you that advice was reflecting the reality of, you know, of what they were, you know, what they were experiencing or what they were seeing. And I suppose, you know, the soft fruit industry in Ireland, especially strawberries, has professionalized a lot quicker than the apple industry, with quite a few large players. If you want to talk about professionalizing in that sense, there's quite a few people, you know, with 30, 40, 50 acres of strawberries, a lot of it grown indoors and so on, and producing very large quantities and selling those quantities literally just through the supermarkets and so on.
Talk to me on then the export import point that I, again, on this one, to listen at home, I don't really have opinions on this. It doesn't affect me as such as an individual. and I play devil's advocate and I ask a person who knows this industry better than me rather than give my opinion on this. I hope there's a differentiation for me anyway in how I put it across with a question mark on the end as versus, and again I double underline it, trying not to give my opinion. Sideshow doesn't do controversy or tries to avoid it as best as possible anyway. We're both giggling. Yeah, I have no problems in my life.
Yeah. No, I don't believe that anyway, but where do I begin answering that? I guess you're going to have to rephrase the question because I can't think of an answer the way...
Okay, so maybe the better way to ask it is, we've had a rough year last year, weather-wise, where it was 3 months of snow and three months of sunshine.
Yeah.
It logically had a knock-on effect on field-grown crops, potatoes, etc., as sure as it did on field-grown crops of a fruiting type in this case. Then the stat comes out in 2019 that X country is importing apples or importing potatoes, when in fact anything the cold stores would have had as a reserve in apples, in your case, they're cold stored, in potatoes similar to cold stored. So what you're eating this year for you listening at home in 2019 or 20 was probably grown in 2018 or 19. That is all being used because of the weather we had last year for this year. So now we're importing them already. So to see that number come back out this year, let's say by a politician saying that, you know, we shouldn't be. Well, the answer is, well, we should if you want your children to eat five greens a day, which is one of the things that you've been promoting, because logically I understand horticulturally why we have.
Yeah, and I think that's a realistic explanation as to why never you won't have all of Ireland's apples grown in Ireland, no matter how much you would like to, you know, no matter how, I suppose, idealistic you wanted to be about it. At the moment, we grow 5% of our own apples. I think we could easily grow 10 or maybe 15%, but that's still not a big proportion. It's still not a big number. But when you start getting into larger amounts, like you're talking about, and I suppose, you know, we would be much more self-sufficient in the potatoes than in apples, for example, you get into that risky area where you will have too many sometimes. So, you know, then you have to export, and that's not the easiest thing to do unless you're doing it on a regular basis. If you're just doing it once every 5 years, you're not going to have market contacts to be exporting to, and so on. And... yeah, if you're already importing, you know, 75, 85, 95% of your fruit, you know, it's not very complicated to move that percentage up or down a little bit. So it's the way the markets work, and there's a huge convenience to the fact that, you know, that Italy or France or whatever grows hundreds of times more apples than we do, and it would only take a tiny amount of their apples to supply our entire market, and they won't notice the difference, you know. So I suppose that's the reality of it.
One of the answers I gave of recent was, if that was the case, I said, well, you shouldn't really be going on a holiday to the south of France. You should be going to Contrastes apple farm. Then he went, ah, come on, Peter, that's different. You're getting on a ship, you're getting on a boat, you're hiring a car, you're doing all the things, your money's going out of the country, but you're complaining about a bag of apples that is a quid or 2 quid or 3 quid.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair analogy, to be truthful. I suppose, you know, it's up to us as growers, the growers that are left, and, you know, those who may want to become growers, and there are a few who are interested in becoming growers, to prove that we can produce what people want at the price that they can afford to pay for them, and so on. And that's something that we are kind of working on, but it's only, you know, it's not the easiest thing to demonstrate, and I don't think we're ever going to be self-sufficient in the likes of apples, at least not the way the climate is now, because we are at a slight climatic disadvantage. Although we do have some advantages, we don't get hail storms in the summer much and that kind of thing, which of course in the warmer continental climates are becoming very common now, with the kind of slightly less stable weather and that kind of thing, so they have to use a lot of hail nets and stuff to protect their orchards from hail. But, you know, it's still, you know, anywhere where there's a large industry, it tends to attract more of that industry. So we have a large beef and dairy industry, especially the dairy, and that tends to consolidate or to attract more people to dairy, as long as it's making money, of course, because there's already the know-how, there's already the efficiency of scale, there's all the big processors and so on. And we don't have that in apple production. So, and it's not a thing that you can build quickly from the ground up.
My daughter, Smella, to those of you who know her, wouldn't be aware of her. Smella Ella is her actual official name. Well, we're big fans of what you do, or she is anyway, and I just get on with you, but also like the stuff, and you'll understand where the giggle is coming in a minute. You'd come down earlier on with a couple of punnets of raspberries, which I would suggest are going to be gone by the time I get back, and there were strawberries, and then there was two bottles of, as I advised her, it's not apple juice, love, please don't drink it, it's cider. For those who are listening, give me a quick snapshot of the range of products that you do, or what I would call you take that thing that grows on the tree and then you put a bow on it. Yeah. And you sell it at a greater premium, let's be frank about that.
Yeah, so if we're just starting, if we just take the apples as a starting point, then we make, I suppose, apple juice, cider vinegar, dried apple slices, and I suppose, yeah, we don't actually make apple tarts, but we do produce apples for making an apple tarts, and we do sometimes sell some apple tarts to some of the people who buy the apples for the apple tarts, give back to us and so on. So I suppose it's not a huge range, but it shows, I suppose, that, you know, the diversity of what apples can be used from. And then if we take some of the other products, oh yeah, we make an apple jelly as well, sorry. And then if you take some of the other products, so you start mixing in the raspberries or the strawberries or the plums or whatever, so we make blended juices with apple and strawberry or apple and raspberry, and then we make some carbonated juices as well, so they're fizzy juices as opposed to still juices, but similar, very similar product, but just a slightly different flavor when you carbonate them. And I suppose, yeah, so if you go across the whole range, there's probably like possibly 30 products that we're making from the original raw materials that we're growing.
I took a photograph of your apple vinegar, Conn's apple vinegar, to give it its official title, and I sent it to a mate of mine, and he sent me a note back saying, it looks like a now new, inverted commas, but old, they tend to do them in those old apothecary style bottles now. And he said, it looks like a bottle of whiskey that I'd pay 50 or 70 or 80 quid for. And in fact, it's just, your marketing one is top of the class, no question about it. And that's just me walking in from a guy who's seen, I guess, or been in the industry a long time. Yeah, I probably should rethink that line, but I'll leave it in anyway. And then the other thing was, last year when I was here, I was feeding your donkey a couple of apples. Mm-hmm. And a couple had come and camped or pitched their tent beside us with their kids. And of course, when you check into your campsite, the first thing you get is the bottle of Conn's apple juice, which is fine. They'd obviously gone down. And I was just saying in my head, I'll give this a half an hour now. We're up feeding the donkey. And lo and behold, they walk straight back around the corner in to buy another three bottles of apple juice, another four bottles of cider, yeah, two packets of whatever the case would be. Bernie Goldback, who's a good friend of mine, who met me here, I think it was about 3 years ago. Bernie comes in, he's looking for your apple rings, and I was saying, I didn't even know that you did them. Your marketing is absolute genius, but how you've taken what I guess was an old, inverted commas, or an industry that hasn't really changed nor needed to, which is the growing of a fruit, put a bow on it, but made it, I'll go back to what I said, maybe it was in episode one, which was that you sort of made a product quite niche, but also high profile. And you've done it very, very simply, but you've done it extremely well. I really do have to give you credit on that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, the people who do the designs and that, obviously, I just have to take their advice on those kind of things. But I'm glad I've got some, you know, some very competent people doing that. You know, I suppose one of the advantages of being in a business where we deal with the general public quite a lot is that they get to tell us, you know, things that they have seen somewhere else or things they'd like. So, you know, it's probably 25 years since some German fella came in and told me I should start making cider vinegar, and I didn't start that year, or maybe not even for 5 years, but the idea was still in my head when I had eventually had too much apple juice. Do you know what I mean? I said, okay, well, maybe I can make some cider vinegar. This, I remembered him coming in and telling me how popular it was in Germany and so on. And again, you see other things somewhere else, you know, apple rings, apple crisps over in Italy one time when I was there, and it's just in the back of your head. And then you begin to say, oh, well, if I don't do this now, somebody's going to start importing apple rings from Italy and I'll miss my opportunity to do some, you know. So those are the kind of things that just, you know, jump along. But it's mostly because the public are coming into us. If I was selling apples to a supermarket, I'd never really know. I wouldn't have that kind of stimulation, I suppose, from people making suggestions to me.
In Irish products, there's you, there's Kyo's Crisps, there's Brigida Burned Salmon. I think Country Crest do it on the large potatoes, which aren't between the 35 millimetre and 80 millimetre that you would get in a domestic bag of Roosters or potatoes at home. Was those that can't go through the grading system now become those dinner potatoes that you'd cut in quarters and put a bit of sauce in the middle. And lo and behold, you can go in and you can get that now. And it's the point of taking a product that you might get 10 pence for. You put it into a cellophane tray or one of those trays, any presentable cardboard eco trays, and you put a dollop of something in the middle of it and all of a sudden it's £3. You revolutionised the potato.
Yeah.
All over again by presentation, marketing and being bloody clever.
Yeah, but you mentioned earlier on that my little bits and pieces are for sale inside in James Whelan's, and you know, he did the ultimate in that with beef dripping, which was something that people were nearly afraid to eat at one stage because of what it might do to your heart or whatever. He won a golden fork for it in the Great Taste Awards, and you know what I mean, and then selling it in Harrods and all the rest. Sometimes it is just a reinvention, you know what I mean, but it's hitting it at the right time, you know, and then maybe, you know, looking at it in a way that other people don't.
You do all of this on site too. I know whiskies that are now being blended, Irish whiskies, where the water has been taken from the well on that site, sent to, let's say, Cork, being produced down there and then being transported all the way back so that they can say, well, we've used the water from that well and therefore it's our whiskey. And I'm scratching my head going, ah, why don't you just build a plant on the island and get it over and done with and do it properly? You've not gone that direction where it's Conn's apples sent out and they stick your name on the top of it and off you go.
Yeah, no, that's true. But I suppose our scale is fairly small, so it allows us to do that. You know, it's not a wonder that you didn't. We know when Bernie was getting the apple rings that you didn't know they were there, because half the time they aren't there because we don't have a big enough dryer to dry them quick enough for the customers that are coming in. So we need another dryer and so on. But I'm prepared just to be a bit patient with that. But some people would just say, to hell with this, I'm going to outsource it to somebody with a massive crisp dryer or whatever it is. Do you know what I mean? But we're happy enough just to really, because we only use our own fruit as ingredients, I'm kind of limited to how big I can get with anything anyway, because then if I got too big too quick, then I'd have to start buying fruit and I don't want to do that. So, you know, that kind of constrains how quick I can make things bigger anyway.
For those of you who haven't now as yet, in the middle of all of that you've heard between episode 1 and episode 2 is a quite small campsite with a farm shed and the greatest, inverted commas, camper's kitchen that this guy has ever seen, considering I've got two tents. One will take more than one person, hence the Ella Maximella, the small daughter, and now a little bit taller, I should say. Unknownst to you, I've been raising my hand to indicate her height, and now I realise that you're actually listening to this and you can't see my hand gesturing that. But that's part of the reason why I come down here and at the very, very start of it noted to you that it was a inverted commas holiday, because I'm surrounded by the best of the best fruit trees. Everything is labelled. I'm looking at the 1999 orchard, and that's CV4. There's car 11 there. Cadia is all labelled, and it's all why I remember. There's a little bit of nostalgia, but it's one of the most magical places on earth, and if you're privileged enough to be down this neck of the woods, it's higher than highly recommended. Come see it, come meet the man himself and have a chat. It really, Con, it's always a pleasure. And on this occasion, I'm glad to say now I'll get to finish my apple now.
Okay, great. Well, the pleasure was all mine. So thank you very much, Peter.
Yeah, thanks for the cider.
Delighted to be on the side show.
Thanks for the cider.
Yeah.
Hold on. If we were the BBC Radio Sheffield or one of them, we'd get an award for this podcast for putting that apple sound effect in. I'm trying to giggle with a mouthful of apple. What? Yeah. Right. Anything you need, at Sideshow on Twitter. Facebook.com/Sideshow.com. Hope you enjoyed it. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.